Welcome to another episode of The Human Way. I'm your host, Matt Havens, and on today's episode, it's a special one because I'm talking to internationally known keynote speaker, Jeff Havens. Yes, coincidentally, he might also be my brother, so this episode is full of some brotherly humor and jabs at each other. I hope you'll enjoy it. But we get to talk about the Great Resignation. We also talk about Jeff's approach to change management and how we as people can all be better at change management if we recognize how good we are to start. It was a fun time. I hope you enjoy it, and so let's get started. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Appreciate being here. It's good to see you.
I'm not gonna lie, this feels weird. You know, this is different, right? It's I can't decide if this is a podcast or if this is like the Thanksgiving, you know, dinner table or what.
Well,
this is,
you know, we're missing a beer or two, but other than that, it's and we're not in the same room, but
correct.
Other than that, it's like hanging out.
Yeah, well, I'm excited that I've been asking Jeff to be on for a little while now, just because and we'll talk about this, but I think, you know, Jeff's had an interesting career. He's got an interesting perspective on work and life, and I think it'd be valuable. But we've always kind of like joked around of like, I don't want to have my brother on the podcast, and he wasn't sure if he wanted to be on it. So I don't know how we got to this point, but I'm excited you're here.
I'm going to go with a desperate lack of interest on the part of people to be on your show. That's, I think, why I'm here.
Everybody. Yeah, it's very possible. It's very possible. You know, your first one I've done in about a month because we've been a little crazy around here. But
you've had plenty going on.
But yes, let's go with that. And I'm sure throughout this entire time, we'll have little jabs at each other, which I'm excited for. Just, you know, because you are such an influencer online and have such a big presence and following, for those that are listening and maybe don't know who you are because they've been living under a rock, will you just tell people a little bit about who Jeff Havens is and what you've been doing for the last 15 years?
Yeah, that's no problem. That's hilarious. The huge influencer online. There's like one thing that I actively avoid. It's, you know, social media engagement. But so for the last 15 years, I have been delivering keynote presentations at conferences all across the world. For the last 8 or 9 years, I think we have been doing online video training on a variety of topics. And the goal with all of it is to make it as entertaining as it is educational. So I have a background as an educator. I have a background as a stand-up comedian. Combined those two things together. So we try to make sure that something that is typically presented in a sort of dry, boring lecture style way is presented in a way that you're engaged and you're laughing and you're having fun without compromising the education that's a part of the, you know, the whole thing. So that's what I've been doing. I've been managing to make it work and trick people into paying me for 15 years. So rock on.
Hopefully, yeah,
for a few more.
Yeah. So, I mean, I always tell people when I got into this industry and this business, it was, of course, because I had family members that had been doing it for a long time. But you kind of made that, I think you made a jump a little bit quicker than maybe others did at the time, or maybe would do so today, where it's like you said, you were a high school English teacher, and then went down the sort of what I would say more of like the formal comedy route of nightclubs and stand up and all of that. But then, I mean, how long did you do that before you then started getting I'll call the event space?
Let's be fair. I had a quicker transition in, I think, because I also had help. You know, Dad is or was a stand-up comedian, is still the right word. He's at the tail end of his career. I know he wants to perform into his 70s, which are coming up. But he saved me 3 or 4 years of time, I think, opening some doors that I might have opened on my own, but maybe not. I don't really know. And actually, the first five times I got paid to do stand-up comedy, I was opening for him, which was super cool. It was a ton of fun for me. He said it was the most nervous he's ever been on stage, but not even being on stage, just being in the wings, watching me, seeing if I was going to tank or not. So, you know, he saved me a ton of time. And then what ended up happening ultimately, this was in my mid-20s, is I was looking for ways to make enough money to make this into a living, which is really hard to do in the unknown comic nightclub world. You know, if you're just touring around the upper Midwest, which is where I was at the time, it's just really, really hard to make a living. So what everybody tries to do is find venues that pay you more. So that would be church fundraisers, county fairs, college campuses, cruise ships, corporate events. And so I was looking for work in those spaces. And I think where it started was in the college market. I had an agent, I was, you know, touring around doing colleges, and they had sort of two sectors There was one that was pure entertainment, and there was one that was called lecture. And I had the idea to create a comedy lecture because there were a lot of people playing in the entertainment space. There was almost nobody playing in the lecture space, and everyone who was there was like really serious. So I put together a presentation called How to Get Fired, which was designed to help students make the transition from college to their working life by encouraging them in a very, you know, sarcastic way, not to follow my advice, but basically encouraging them to be terrible. So it was a fake your resume, establish your incompetence, destroy your work ethic, and then alienate your coworkers. Those were the four pillars of poverty. Put that together. And it worked out well, that sort of backwards approach to, you know, basically, here's the message, I'm going to turn it upside down. And then I started taking that into the corporate world too. So it was that idea that I think allowed me to accelerate into the corporate keynoting space faster. And I think more in a more entrenched way than if I had just tried to take my stand-up comedy and made it all, you know, G-rated, PG-rated, corporate friendly, yeah, and run as a corporate entertainer.
Yeah. So, I mean, in those early days, and obviously I know you've worked it out now to where you can do this pretty effortlessly, but in those early days, was it tough to make, to like mentally make the jump of, oh, I'm talking to a corporate audience now versus, you know, a 10 PM nightclub, in a comedy club?
The hard part was not, who I'm talking to. It was what I was saying. So as a stand-up comic, you have a very immediate feedback. Like if I say something and you laugh, I win. If you don't laugh, I lose, you know? And then at the end of the night, you get to decide which jokes are working, which jokes aren't. And you can, you know, use that information to kind of tailor your act and get better and figure out where you should improve things. But then I was being asked, you know, in the college space and in the corporate space, we want you to say some stuff that's not supposed to be fun. We want you to say some things that are supposed to be educational. And I remember the first, you know, several times doing that where I'm like, okay, I got 3 minutes coming up here where nobody's going to laugh. Like, I don't know if they like this. I don't know what to do. It was so nerve wracking. And, but eventually you get used to that and you trust, you know, people give you a different sort of response. So are they attentive? Are they leaning forward? Are they looking at you? Are they staring at their phones? Are they, you know, taking notes, any of those kinds of things. And you realize that that is basically their version of laughter, right? Because you're not looking for laughter, you're looking for engagement. And so now I've gotten comfortable with that. So now the idea of going into an environment where the only thing I'm supposed to do is make people laugh, now that makes me nervous because I'm like, whoa, I don't know how to make people laugh all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to try it. I'm going to have to go back and do some stand-up comedy at some point and make sure that I can still actually do it.
Yeah. So I have that same, you know, I guess challenge, but maybe on the reverse side as you, because when I came in, I kind of started with the generational conversation, which is absolutely, it's like over the top entertainment in my opinion.
Yeah.
But, you know, and like you said, and like you said, like, you know, that people, I know where people are going to laugh. I know what the laughs are probably going to sound like. I know if I executed it correctly, or, you know, in my mind, how it's supposed to be to get the biggest laugh, the most entertainment. And then more recently I've been doing talks that are less comedic. It's more, call it motivational. It's more content based. And I'm having to kind of relearn, oh yeah, what's the value for the audience in that? So, I mean, How are you now, well into your career, where early on maybe it was like more heavy on the entertainment side, and I'm sure, and I know your career still is in that regard, but like, what does that adjustment look like? How do you adjust in that for that different type of message?
What's ultimately happened is that over the course of the last like 10 years, the presentations have, they started out being heavily entertainment based and very light on the content. And as I've done more presentations and done more research and learned more, basically, each one of my presentations has become much more of like this 55-45 split. And I go back and forth in my own head about which one I want to be 55. Is it the entertainment, or is it supposed to be the, you know, the content and the education? But the goal is to make sure that it never feels like it's too heavy in one direction. One of the challenges with humor is that people think often that it by definition means that it's not educational. Yeah. So if they're laughing at something, they are not learning anything at that moment, which isn't true, but you can't tell people that how they feel isn't accurate. So figuring out how to make sure that your entertainment isn't interfering with the education that you're trying to share almost necessarily means that you're going to have, you know, more, like I said, more like this 50-50 balance as opposed to like an 80-20 balance. Now, in terms of like what I'm looking for from an audience, my barometer for success is number of people or percent of audience who is doing something else while I'm talking. You know, are they looking at their phone? Or are they typing on their computer because they're at a conference and they're using this to catch up on work? If it's under 5%, then I win. It's almost never 0% because, you know, it's 400 people in a room and some of them, you know, have calls they have to take right now. And so they take them. I understand that. I don't get mad about it. But as long as I feel like I'm under 5% of the audience is doing something else, I got 95% engagement, then or better, you know, then rock on. I did well.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I mean, I just sent a text while you were talking because you kind of bored me there a little bit, but you know, I get it.
No, I know your attention span. You're only 5 years younger, but it's just young enough to not be able to focus on one thing. So.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I have full blown undiagnosed ADHD where I literally have 20 times a day, it's squirrel and I'm just off doing something different.
It's always a squirrel. I'm so surprised by that. The ADD people, it's literally always a squirrel. They never say wombat. They never say any other animal. It's always a squirrel.
Because squirrels are cute. I mean, so I don't know.
Wombats. Have you seen a wombat? They're adorable.
But how many wombats have you seen in your life, huh?
I don't know. I mean, if it's out of the corner of your eye, you can't tell me if it's a squirrel or a wombat. That's all I'm saying.
I digress. We're going to go way too far down this path if we allow it to happen.
They live in Australia. That would be, you know, an argument you could have employed.
Yeah. Jeff, I don't know anything about wombats. Okay. I'm sorry. You know, it's not my area of expertise.
I get National Geographic for kids.
So. well, there you go. But that does actually kind of in a weird way lead me to like another thing that I think is really kind of interesting about your career, about what you speak on is, you don't have like a thing. And what I mean by that is if, you know, I'm going to go to look at some of the people that are out there that do this job and do it extremely well and are, you know, well-known, you know, like Simon Sinek, I just think of like thought leader, right? Or a specific topic around leadership. And quite frankly, when your name comes up, you talk about so many different topics, ideas, you know, things that would be beneficial for such a wide variety of industries and conferences and events and companies. It's certainly something like I've, you know, admired about you. Like, how do you do that? Like, how do you have such breadth of knowledge and a message to deliver while you're also, you know, entertaining the audience and making them laugh along the way?
Well, the thing that I think is sort of different about my approach is I'm actually trading on my delivery. I'm trading a little bit less on the content. People don't come to me as a subject matter expert, like you're the customer service guy or you're the leadership guy. They come to me because they like the way that I do what I do. And that's actually what they're buying. I would say, you know, like 50, maybe 60% of my contracts, when they're actually signed to do a presentation, the topic is listed as TBD because they haven't even decided what they want me to do yet. They just know they like the way that I do it. And we'll figure out as we're talking, you know, what specifically they're looking for. So part of it is that I've really focused on how do I deliver information, and that's going to be my differentiator. But part of it also is for me is just getting bored. Like I personally cannot imagine spending, you know, 10, 20, 35 years picking a single idea and staring at it to death. It does not appeal to me. And what I'm trying to do with a lot of the topics that I touch on is I'm trying to make them as simple as possible for people. I don't want things to be complicated. And so I actually don't even believe that you need to have 19 different books on leadership because I don't think there's a lot of nuances in there, but I don't think that the broad strokes that you need to, you know, apply to your leadership canvas are all that great in number. So my goal not only is to provide, you know, an entertaining approach to education, but my goal is also to simplify topics that I feel have been made overly complicated by other people. And some of that I think comes from where your incentives are. Like I don't consult with anybody. Yeah. So I'm not incentivized to convince you that what I'm talking about is so complicated that you really need to hire me for a 12-month contract to help sort things out at your business. I'm incentivized to help people think in the course of, you know, 45 minutes or 75 minutes about a topic in a way that helps them move forward, you know, for the next few weeks or months.
Yeah.
So I need to figure out how to make these things digestible for people. And so that's kind of what I do. But anyway, so, you know, I want to apply this delivery and I get bored personally with thinking about one topic. So, okay, what's the next one? How can I take this other complicated thing and make it simple and entertaining for people? And so that's kind of what I've done.
Yeah. No, I mean, I like how you've of course done that. And, you know, one of the things that I think relates to that is that it got us talking about, hey, you know, let's just do a podcast episode to kind of talk a little bit, is when we talk about simplifying things and making it easier. You recently wrote an article, and I think it's out on your blog at Jeff Havens, but you know, how the Great Resignation can work to your advantage. And this is a topic that you and I, you know, offline have talked about this idea, because I've got maybe some ideas and thoughts around it too. But for those who, you know, haven't visited your website to view your blog, can you talk a little bit about this? The Great Resignation is getting so much talk these days. Can you just share a little bit about your perspective on what's going on there?
Yeah. Well, so the article was basically how you use it to your advantage. So if you are a business person, or if you are a company that's lost employees and you attribute it to this Great Resignation, what you need to be doing is look at that as a learning opportunity. What are the reasons that they are leaving for, and how much of that are you able to, you know, impact or have an influence over? Some people are leaving for reasons that are entirely out of your control. You know, like their kids are still home from school, they're caring for older folks or their parents, they've gotten sick. They've decided to move and your business absolutely does not allow them to work remotely. There's, you know, so those reasons are beyond your control and you really shouldn't take it personally. They've made choices that work for them. That's what all of us do. And they're doing that, and that's fine. But some of the reasons that people are resigning are absolutely within your power. Some of it has to do with their interactions with their boss, how meaningful they feel like their job is, whether or not they're able to do their job the way that they now want to, or maybe the way they've always wanted to, but now they realize it's actually an option where before they didn't think it was, you know, specifically with the working remote flexibility standpoint. And if those are things that you can adjust in order to meet employees where they want to be, then you should. You know, I mean, that's how you show them that you care about them, that you value them, that you're giving them what they're looking for. And when you do that for them, they give you what you want, which is, you know, loyalty, dedication, productivity, and all those other kinds of things. For the people who are hiring, who are getting new employees in, you have to appreciate the fact that they have done the exact same thing. They just haven't done it with you. They have been thinking about, what do I want out of the world? What do I want out of life? And they've ultimately decided that you are what they want. They've spent a lot of time looking for what they have been looking for. They've decided it's you. You have this golden opportunity to make sure that these people, you know, realize they made the right choice and stay with you for forever, as long as you figure out, you know, what exactly is it about us that attracted you here? And, you know, there's a lot of factors in there, and you have to ask them to figure out what it is. Is it the pay? Is it the benefits? Is it the flexibility? Is it the community? Is it the, you know, opportunity for growth? Whatever it is, figure that out and then use those as, you know, the drivers of your marketing, the drivers of your employee attracting and retention, you know, moving forward. So there's a lot of positive to take out of what looks on the surface like a very negative thing.
Yeah. And I think you hit on something that's really important there, is the ownership of the control that companies or leaders or organizations have. What has been frustrating to me at times, I guess, to see or to read or to, you know, talk with peers and friends about, you know, the Great Resignation, is it's this idea that it's all of an external force that's happened to us, right? And I absolutely don't think that's the case. I think there is some of that, sure, but so much of this, if we step back and look at, like kind of like you said, like, what control did we have as an organization or leader to either make this a better place to work that people don't want to go and do something differently? Or where I thought your article was really interesting is that idea of the people that are coming in, like, they're coming in because they've chosen you. So what is it about your organization that you are doing well and that we need to, like, really lift up?
I, I think that the biggest change that has happened is that for 50 years, since the 1970s, the pendulum, the balance of power has been in the favor of employers. Wages have stayed stagnant. The pay gap between senior leadership and entry-level workers has continued to climb. And it's been that way for 50 years. And then throw in about 10 years ago, throw in the gig economy, which it took that into overdrive. You have no benefits. You have no security. You have really no connection to this company other than a paycheck that you have a limited ability to influence. That's been going for 50 years. And then the pandemic happens and the pendulum for the first time in 50 years swings in favor of employees. And it's gone back and forth throughout history, but now it's swinging back in favor of employees. And every intelligent person everywhere is trying to figure out how to use that to their advantage, as they should. That's what all of us do. And so that's why you see, you know, employers raising wages and changing working conditions to attract intelligent workers who realize that they have a little bit more power than they did before, and they're going to get as much out of it as they possibly can. You got this this attitude, I think, among a lot of employers that, oh, they're just lazy. They don't want to work. It's like, yeah, they do. They definitely want to work and they're going to work hard, but they don't want to work under any circumstances. They want to work under circumstances that make sense to them. And they want to work under the most favorable circumstances that they can find. And in that sense, they're just like everybody else.
Yeah.
So getting mad at them for trying to get the best life for themselves that you can is not only ridiculous, but it's counterproductive. Instead, you need to figure out, well, what can you give people and what do you expect in return? But you need to appreciate the fact that first time in 50 years, the pendulum has moved in favor of employees. And it might be annoying, but you know, it's part of the cycle of business. It's part of the cycle of work.
Yeah. I think of all the changes that organizations had to make, you know, when the pandemic hit and we have to work differently. And I think at times there were some that just thought, oh, this is just a temporary thing. It's a temporary way of, and you know, after 6 months, we'll be able to get back to, you know, people aren't going to want to work from home. And then they realized that, yes, there's still a majority of people that want to come back to the office, but you know what? There's a pretty significant amount of people that really liked this and they got work done and they were able to operate that way. So we have to maybe continue to think differently. And if we don't, and if we say, oh, we just got to go back to the way that it was, then I think that's when you're going to see people look and find more creative ways to work and to live. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Heck, I wish I knew about like NFTs and how I could flip those for 40 grand a day or whatever. Can you help the audience with that, Jeffrey?
I can try. So I know there was a sculptor in Spain who sold an invisible sculpture for $18,000 to somebody.
Yes.
There have always been idiots who are happy to spend too much money on stupid crap. So find some stupid crap, make some stupid crap, sell some stupid crap. Good for you. Congratulations, taking advantage of people who had more money than you had to spend.
Hey, I think we just found the new keynote for Jeff Havens. Sell, find, create stupid crap. It's going to sweep the nation. I'm excited for that.
It certainly could. Yeah.
But you know, the other thing that I just want to like maybe touch on a little bit too, that I have noticed with your work that you do talk a lot. And I think you talk really intelligently about change management. And I'm going to get the keynote names wrong because you're my brother. I don't really care that much, honestly.
Yeah, so no, that's fine. Yeah.
Go to your website. But you do a really good job talking about how when we think about change management and how that drives fear into a lot of people and organizations, how there's whole entire departments of how do we deal with change at an organization. I think you really break it down very simply that we are all constantly going through change and we are much better at handling it than we maybe give ourselves credit for. Would you just share a little bit? I'm not asking you to give away the whole keynote, but share a little bit about your thoughts around change management.
Yeah, well, the easiest way to point that out is just the last 2 years, literally zero people on this planet are the same person they were 2 years ago, you know, before the pandemic. It has changed every single person. And that is a big, giant, massive, unexpected change. That's all fine. Pick any other 2 year period of your life, pick you from 10 to 12, pick you from 20 to 22, or make it bigger, make it a 5 year change, pick you from 25 to 30, 50 to 55. Everybody's changing all the time. The problem is we're so good at dealing with change that we constantly forget that we've done it. And so when it is presented to us, when we are aware that a change is going to happen, that's when we worry that we can't handle it, even though we're so good at handling it that we do it mostly unconsciously all the time. And it's the only skill that I can think of, literally the only skill everyone is an expert at. You know, there's like breathing and pooping. I think most people are pretty good at that, although occasionally people have trouble with those. But everybody is a master at managing change. The trick, I think, is to know what you're worried about, know why you're afraid that there's change is coming. There are several reasons that it makes sense to resist change. What are those reasons? Why are you concerned? What can you do to mitigate those concerns? And then the other thing too is to appreciate, you know, how much control you actually have. Like, what can you influence? What can't you influence? And do what you can with the parts that you have control over. And, you know, accept the fact that every so often life's going to throw something at you that you didn't see coming, that maybe nobody saw coming. And that's, you know, that's part of life. And one of the best examples of that, I think, is becoming a parent, because I know you've got your 8-year-old daughters and I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. And literally, and I'm comfortable saying this, even though I haven't talked to every single parent on the planet, literally zero parents became parents and then knew exactly how it was going to go, you know, for the next 15 years. You are constantly making it up and stuff is constantly coming out of left field that you didn't see coming. And you know what you do? You deal with it. You figure it out. Same as everybody else. And so if I think that becoming a parent actually changes people more profoundly in more ways than any other change ever, including the pandemic. And if that's one that, you know, is so natural that people, you know, do it every single day, billions and billions and billions of people have done that one. Pretty sure you can handle the other changes that come your way too.
Yeah. So would you say becoming a parent was like the biggest change that you personally have had to go through?
Well, yeah, I would say the most comprehensive in terms of how many different facets of my life that it changed. Yeah. I mean, I've changed careers and that's a big change. I got divorced and that's a massive change. The pandemic changed a ton of stuff for people. Pandemic is probably the closest, I think, to a like as fully comprehensive change as becoming a parent is. And there's probably some other ones that, you know, I'm not thinking of or that haven't personally happened to me that, you know, seem to affect literally every element of your life. Yeah. But I don't think that it's like just one thing. And I also don't think that those are insurmountable difficulties. In most cases, what we tend to do is figure out how to handle them. And and so my goal with change management is to just get people to be aware of the fact that they already know how to do it. Like, I'm not going to teach you anything new, because that's sort of arrogant for me to assume that I somehow know how to change better than you do. I mean, you've experienced 10,000 changes in your life, and so have I. Yours might be different than mine, but whatever. The act of you managing those 10,000 changes and turning them into the you that's sitting here right now is identical. The process is identical to the one that I've used to get to be sitting here right now. So I can't really teach you anything. I can just make you aware of the fact that you already have these skills.
I think sometimes that's important, right? Just like stepping back to recognize you've been through these things. You can handle it. It's a different scenario. It's different circumstances, but you've done it and you can. And just knowing that you can.
One of the arguments I tend to make for people is like, if you're worried about a current change, a really good strategy for being more confident about it is to look back in your past at changes that are done, changes you have experienced that are over that you would consider to have been somehow a net positive. That doesn't mean you enjoyed the change while it was happening, but you know, it's over now. Like an IT upgrade, that's a great example, right? 6 years ago, we upgraded our software. We all hated it. Nobody wanted to go through the change. And now we're pretty happy with it, that kind of thing, right? Yeah. If you can find some positive out of previous negative changes, you will probably be able to find some positives out of the changes that are coming up, you know, in your near future. And so use your past as sort of a booster for your present.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think that's good advice for everyone. So I'll ask you, as the older of the three brothers that we have in our family, when you look back, what was the net positive of you starting to lose your hair at such an early age?
I had, I guess, less money I needed to spend on haircuts and hair care products.
Very
I
good.
I see a lot of gel.
There's some product in this bad boy.
Yeah. Your hair right there. Yeah. I don't have to spend as much money on that. I'm using that money to buy some NFTs, actually. So looking forward to being able to flip those and buy a house with it. So I think there's that. You get to trade on being distinguished a little bit earlier, although for being the youngest member of the family, you got more gray in your hair than anybody else does.
I do. Think, right? Yeah, I do. It is coming in. It's coming in pretty hard.
You can maybe give me a run for your money in terms of being like really distinguished. But that's sort of about it. I don't know. Chicks dig bald dudes. So.
Oh, well, Jeff, I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure to have you on this. I feel like we need to start just like a brother podcast where we can just kind of rail on each other for, you know, various moments throughout the day, and we can talk about NFTs or whatever it is that you want to talk about. But
it would not be hard for us to find topics that you and I disagree on and then argue about. So
yes. Yeah, so ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here. It's the Brotherly Argument podcast. We'll be launching January of 2020.
Brotherly love.
But
brotherly hate, let's call it that.
Brotherly hate. Okay. I mean, you know, it's a little play on words. I like it. I still love you though. But hey, look, Jeff, thank you very much. For those that need to go find Jeff, he's out on jeffhavens.com. And like you said, he's not on social media. I mean, it's probably, you're not going to find him there, but he is in those places.
Not much
as well too, if you need to get a hold of
him. I'm losing my hair. I'm old.
I know.
Yeah. I'm not gray.
But you're not great, that's for sure. So thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds good. Awesome. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, man.